We acknowledge and pay our respects to the Kaurna people, the traditional custodians of the ancestral plains on which this podcast was recorded. We pay our respect to elders past and present, and extend that respect to all First Nations peoples who are listening.
Ecofuturist takes on the challenge of imagining a brighter, greener, cleaner future through conversation and big ideas.
That's what art does. It reports on the condition of being human.
When we're dealing with climate change, there can be a sense of loss, that grief can turn into something positive.
The sense of urgency that society has now is a great thing, but you can only maintain a sense of emergency and crisis for so long.
There's only one way forward now, and that's all of us, you know, to actually sort of stand up and say no.
Get ready to press play on a better tomorrow. This is Ecofuturists. The human body is not separate from the natural environment. It's part of it. Think about it. When the days get shorter over winter, we get more tired. Or when the pollen count rises, our allergies become unbearable. But also, when the natural environment is in decline, it can have real public health impacts. Our management of ecosystems and biodiversity can help support public health outcomes. And there are a broad range of benefits we can obtain from green spaces in our cities. Hi, I'm Professor Andy Lowe, and I'm looking forward to discussing the topic of reversing nature deficit with my guests today, Dr. Jess Stanhope and Professor Phil Weinstein. Jess is lecturer in physiotherapy at the University of Adelaide, and Phil is Professor of Public Health, also at the University of Adelaide. Today I have in the studio Professor Phil Weinstein, Professor of Public Health at the University of Adelaide, and Dr. Jess Stanhope, lecturer in physiotherapy, also from the University of Adelaide. Welcome.
Thank you.
Around 250 years ago, the Industrial Revolution took people away from farms and villages and put them into urban centres where much of the work was done indoors, away from sunny surrounds. In time, factories turned into offices. But does a part of us still need to be outdoors? Jess, what do you think?
So we've evolved with being outdoors, so it's quite natural for us to be in those environments.
2 million years of evolution outdoors, right?
That's it. Yeah. So there's a reason that we are supposed to be outside. And a lot of the developments that you speak of were initially developed to kind of protect us from elements of the outdoors. But in a way, we've kind of gone a bit too far now that so much of our life is spent indoors and with, say, windows that don't open and things like that that really restrict our access. But it's really important because there's elements of the outdoors that's key for our health and our well-being. So it can be relaxing. We've got emerging evidence that it can shape your microbiome. It's a place to socialise and exercise. So there's lots of benefits of spending time outdoors, and it's becoming increasingly hard with urbanisation as well. So that's also something that's changed our relationship with the outdoors.
So there's a few things that I recognise, a few things I didn't. Socialising, relaxing, exercising. But what is microbiome? What's that?
So the microbiome refers to essentially the little ecosystem that's on us or in us. It's actually everywhere. There will be microbes around.
So it's an ecosystem of microbes that live on and in us.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yes. Yeah. So that's the natural response, I guess, historically. And again, that's why we've moved towards indoors and having, you know, really hygienic environments. But increasingly, we're discovering how important it is to have a healthy microbiome. So that's thought to be something that's quite diverse, because there's a lot of the functions of our own bodies are reliant on those beneficial microbes. So you might have heard of things like probiotics, so different drinks and things, or even in yogurts. So same kind of idea, but when we're spending time in an environment, we're actually taking on all of the microbes in that environment. So if it's a nice biodiverse outdoor space, then the microbes are probably, or the microbiome is probably going to be more diverse. And so as a result of that, what we then kind of take on in our bodies is going to be, or thought to be, more diverse as well. And that allows us to better fight infections. It's also thought to be associated with mental health, maybe even things like pain. So there's a whole range of health conditions that might be benefiting from us actually spending time outside.
Hmm. So Phil, what's the microbiome? How important is it that we get that microbiome right for our general health?
So as Jess has said, we've evolved with it. So that's what we're adapted to do. And with change, with cultural evolution, if you like, there's been a change in disease burden. So when we lived outdoors, we had things like, you know, malaria and cholera that would kill us. And then we built cities and we no longer have that problem, but we're developing apparently a problem from nature deprivation. And that can be both psychological, because there's a biophilia hypothesis, it's called, that, you know, we've adapted to loving nature and seeing green and seeing biodiversity. And part of that is the microbiome exposure that we're discussing. So the diversity of microbes that we're exposed to in the environment are thought to train the immune system. And the immune system links to the endocrine system, to our hormones and to our brain, and through those mechanisms to everything else. So the range of disease outcomes that Jess is referring to can be a result of malalignment, if you like. All of those things can be adverse outcomes from having microbiome deprivation, if you like. If it's not training your immune system appropriately, you get more allergies, more asthma, more infections, more autoimmune diseases.
So it's a kind of deficit syndrome, isn't it?
We've
evolved. But not all microbes are good, right? So there's a lot of pathogenic microbes that presumably we can do without, but it's getting the balance between the good ones and the bad ones, I guess.
Absolutely. And that's that trade-off, the change in disease burden. So we have to try and regain the benefit from environmental microbiome exposure, if you like, without having the diseases that we've left behind attached, like the malaria and the cholera and whatever else.
But I think it's important to remember that the environmental microbiome refers to even the indoor environment. So if you're indoors, you're actually exposed to microbes as well, and they're typically not going to be as healthy. So more likely to be the pathogens. So that's one of the challenges, I guess, in talking about this. Often people go, oh, no, there's pathogens outside, without recognizing that indoors we have those risks as well, if not worse in those environments.
So even with all our COVID procedures, we've still got microbes in and around us every day on every surface, haven't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we've got this kind of theoretical understanding of microbes. Good microbes are good for us, let's put it that way. How do we start bringing that into a system of change for people?
So I guess if we look to the clinical sciences, there's a lot of evidence and a lot of research already developing in fixing your gut microbiome. The balance of microbes in your intestines has helped.
So as Jess said, the yogurts and the probiotics that we can ingest. So we're really aiming for good health through those.
That's one of the big components.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is formed fairly early in life, depending on whether you're, you know, breastfed or you have a cesarean birth or whatever your natural environment is. That's the microbes that you're exposed to that then colonize your gut. And yes, you can modify that in various ways, but the basics are fixed fairly early on. As I say, there's a lot of clinical work happening in that space. What we're more interested in is the environmental component, restoring environments and conservation aspects, because there's sort of a polarized approach to public health intervention. One would be to develop a pill that contains the good bugs that you buy at a price and the drug company makes a big profit. And the other one is to restore and improve the green space exposure that people have in a passive sort of way, because the microbes are in the air and you breathe them in. And if that has a health benefit, then you're getting something for free. So our research is more at that public good end of the spectrum.
Mm.
A lot of the public health message depends on behavior change. So improve your diet, get more exercise, stop smoking, wear a COVID mask. People are reluctant to change their behavior for one reason or another, no matter how good the evidence. So the best public health comes when people don't need to change their behavior, but you can improve their lot in life by changing their environment. And good historical examples of that are, for example, cholera control in London in the 1850s, when people were dying like flies. The public health intervention was to improve the water supply so that people didn't get sick. It wasn't telling people, go and get your water from a cleaner part of the city or whatever, because that involved behavior change. And we've got exactly the equivalent situation now with green space. We can tell people, you know, go to the national park and get your kids out to play football. All of those things involve behavior change, whereas passive breathing a diverse environmental microbiome, the microbes that come from having green space close to your house or in the areas that you commute through, like the Torrens Linear Park, if you're getting that healthy green space microbiome exposure passively, then it's a much better and more cost-effective public health intervention that reaches a larger part of the community for free.
How long do we have to spend in green space to get the benefits? Can I just run outside for 5 minutes and get the benefit? How much time do I need to spend?
We don't know yet is the quick answer, I guess, because it would depend on the diversity, what you're doing. So if you're running, maybe you're breathing more deeply and maybe that then changes things. So yeah, we don't yet know. There is some preliminary work happening in this space, but it's quite unclear yet. But it's probably little and often is perhaps better than, you know, big hike on the weekend. If you can get a little bit every day, that's probably going to be more beneficial.
And the nature of the green space and how old you are, all of those factors, as Jess says, unknown. But again, if I can hark back to the precautionary principle, it would seem to be a good thing to do, so therefore do it. And we'll adjust exactly how much you need to do when, later when we know more.
The work of Jacob Mills showed that 20 minutes spent outside by school kids would change the microbes on their skin and that it was built up over time. So
correct.
20 minutes is probably a good place to start.
We don't know if it persists. Okay. It's yeah. It's a good start.
Good start, but it might need to be done regularly.
Yeah.
So, and we don't yet know whether that impacts the gut. That link isn't as clear cut as it, then you could assume it would be.
So it's a really good indicator of exposure. You know the exposure has happened because you can see it on the skin, but you can't translate that to a guaranteed health effect.
And what kind of interventions have you tried so far or tried to influence or have dreamed up?
So this area is really in its infancy in terms of a lot of the research in this area, particularly from an intervention point of view. So there has been some work overseas that's been looking at things like greening childcare centres or putting microbes into sandpits in those childcare centres. And they've demonstrated that there's a change in the microbiome within 2 weeks for those kids. But they're at an age where they're more likely to be modified, or their gut microbiome is more likely to be modified by environmental factors. There has been some work in adults as well in terms of things like rubbing hands in a compost plant-based mix, and that seems to have some change relating to that, but it doesn't seem to persist after the intervention stops. So if you're an avid gardener, you're spending a lot of time, you know, mixing or playing with soil and things, then that's probably going to make a change, but we don't really have an understanding of what that long-term effect might be if that intervention's actually removed. So that's kind of where the science is at the moment from a human point of view. There is a lot of animal work as well supporting this, and that's starting to move towards more the aerobiome, so the microbes that are in the air. So a colleague of ours, Craig Lidicote, did a study a number of years ago. So he was also at the University of Adelaide looking at the aerobiome exposure and found changes in the gut microbiome as well as anxiety-like behaviour, which is really exciting because it means people don't actually have to go out specifically into an environment. As long as that biodiverse environment is close enough to them, they're able to breathe those microbes in. And so that's, again, kind of the childhood stage or into adulthood for those mice. So we've got some preliminary findings from a similar study, which seems to show that pain might be influenced as well. But I think the next step on from that is really what happens when someone's an adult. So we can also test this with animal models before getting into humans, but whether that childhood exposure is actually required to actually benefit later on in adulthood is also really key. So there's a lot to kind of unpack, and it depends really whether we're focusing on prevention, which is what the research has been so far. I think starting to move into how we actually treat people from a more of a clinical perspective, so different to what Phil's been talking about, it's actually bringing the environment into that clinical way of thinking. So it might be changing where we do our therapy, making sure people can go out into biodiverse spaces, can all potentially be things that we're looking at in the future.
So I thought this was going to be a really simple conversation. I thought it was going to be just eat some more yogurt, Andy, and you'll be okay. So there's a couple of things I would like to unpack. So the first one is it's not just about gut health.
Correct.
You've mentioned anxiety, you've mentioned pain, you've mentioned immune system. So How does the microbes in your gut influence all of those other components of your body?
So the term gut health...
And they do, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So the term gut health is really referring, as you'd expect, to the health of the gut, but it doesn't just mean it's gut-related symptoms. So they can certainly be part of it. But because the intestine is so key in terms of our health, because that's where we absorb all of our nutrients, the gut microbiome will change how that happens. So then there'll be a connection, say, with the brain and with immune factors as well related to what's happening in the gut. And so that doesn't necessarily have to be microbiome driven. Obviously, things like diet and other exposures are also key there. But yeah, when we're talking about gut health, particularly with the microbiome, it really is going to affect the whole body. It's not just about gut related symptoms. So really exciting area because of that.
So it's this connection between the brain, the immune system and the gut, the big axis. I still don't really fully understand how what you eat or what's in your stomach affects your brain. Just break it down really simply for me. How can that possibly have an effect?
You just think about alcohol consumption.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I've got it.
No, so the chemicals basically that the microbes produce are what nourishes the intestinal lining in your gut. They don't, like the other parts of the body, depend on circulating blood sugar level. They depend on the products of the intestinal microbes for their energy. And if they don't get enough of that energy, then they get stressed and they send signals to the rest of the body through the endocrine system, which is your hormones circulating that tell you all sorts of different things, and the nervous system as well. So the gut's connected to all of those things. And there's a feed forward mechanism from the gut to all of the other body systems that are controlled by the brain and the endocrine system. But there's a feedback mechanism as well. If you think about the psychological benefit of seeing biodiversity in green space, it's relaxing. It decreases stress. That's why they've got aquaria in dental surgeries to try and decrease the stress level before you get drilled.
And soundproof doors.
Yes. Don't hear the children screaming. Now, so the stress reduction and the blood pressure reduction that you get from being relaxed and watching green space and biodiversity, again, directly affects the nervous system and the endocrine system, the hormone system, and they feed to the gut and can change the microbiome in the gut. Mm. So there's two-way communication, environment, brain, endocrine system, gut microbiome, and trying to keep that in balance is the challenge. And the urbanization that you refer to in your introduction has thrown that out of balance. And that's why we think we've got a lot of the Western type diseases may be associated, at least in part, with that imbalance. It's definitely not a panacea. Mm. Green space exposure and microbiome isn't going to, cure all our ills. But if it's contributing in a significant way to those diseases, that's at a population level with a lot of people, that's still a huge impact and a big cost to the health system.
Yeah. So as part of a balanced, healthy lifestyle, we should be incorporating these. And so in terms of, Jesse, you also talked about the other thing was kind of ages and stages and different types of exposures. And so if we are moving this into a kind of public health domain,
yeah.
You mentioned that it's probably beneficial to have exposure early on in life and then be maintained throughout.
Yes.
And you've done quite a bit of work with mice models to look at this. So what are you really finding in terms of that kind of age and stage exposure?
So what we've done at this stage is similar to the previous study I spoke about, is that really childhood into early adulthood stage. We haven't developed it beyond that. And that was because this is a very new area. So it's really about demonstrating that the aerobiome, so the microbes in the air, could influence the gut microbiome and potentially health outcomes. So our particular study started at the age they were weaned, so about 3 weeks, right through to 11 weeks. This is kind of early 20s-ish kind of in humans. And so, yeah, we don't really have that understanding what goes beyond that. But now that we've got some really promising pilot data, we will be able to hopefully get some funding to extend that work. And then we will be able to look at what happens across the lifespan, particularly as things change over time. So we know that, kids will typically spend more time outside than adults, and that kind of shifts when they get late teenage, early adulthood, when things like work and family commitments and things start to take over. So if we're able to then understand how that changes and how that early exposure might protect against changes later on, and also what happens later on. So we know that when people retire, their activities change as well. So is that actually beneficial? Obviously, it's beneficial in other ways if they're out hiking or playing golf, but whether their microbiome is actually being influenced or whether that actually is reliant on having a really healthy microbiome as a child, because we know that there's certain taxa that won't be taken on if there's not others that are present. So it might be that early exposure is actually required for that lifelong impact. But we don't know enough yet. And a lot of the research, even with microbiome in general, is really tricky because there are so many changes. So as soon as someone has medication or they're less active or their diet changes, that gets really difficult to unpack what those influences are, which is why, you know, having the animal studies is so nice, because we are able to control a lot of that. So it's always going to be that mix, I think, between animal studies and bringing in some of that human work as well.
But you're probably at a no-regret stage, right, to make a recommendation to spend time in nature and green space. There's a number of additional benefits from that.
Yeah.
And one of those is also going to be microbiome exposure.
Yes.
So with that kind of mindset, then what would you recommend? What would you recommend from a public health perspective that we actually do? If we kind of break those down into different categories, what with school-age kids, what would be a good environment that you could encourage?
I think it's really about whatever people are able to do. So in an ideal world, you'd probably have school outside and in forest and do all those things, which might be possible for some people. But
there's some of those
not.
In Germany, right?
Exactly. So Finland's the other one. Yeah. And I've heard there's a couple in Australia, but that's not going to be possible for a lot of people. And part of that is distance to these biodiverse spaces, but also the time that people have available. So it's kind of as much as you can do, I guess, outside. There's no really strict recommendation or guidance on that yet. So again, it's something that we're kind of working towards. But it appears that having that biodiversity is really key. So while an oval might be better than nothing, if you can actually, you know, go for a hike in one of our conservation parks or something like that, is probably going to be more beneficial than kicking a footy around the oval. And bringing kids, you know, into different gardens, if you don't have one at home, things like community gardens, spending time in different environments is really key.
But also playtime at school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Getting outside and not doing it in the classroom, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, there are definitely teachers who will take kids outside into different environments and do their classrooms there, which is fantastic. And certainly if schools can do more planting, obviously getting the kids involved in the planting as well has that double benefit of they've got that direct exposure, but later on they're still exposed, say, through their aerobiome, because it is more diverse. So there's a lot of opportunities.
And Phil, are any environments better than others to spend time in?
Is it,
is a footy pitch, it's green, right? That's surely equivalent to a biodiverse forest somewhere, isn't it?
No. Oh. So sadly, a lot of that understanding is only just developing, but it would appear that the biodiversity per se is actually good, and we don't actually know whether it is the biodiversity or whether it's the range of different microbes, the different taxa that you're exposed to. But if you operate sort of from first principles, you know, we talked just earlier about how the perception of biodiversity, looking at green space, relaxes you, and that operates through the body's neurological and endocrine translation mechanisms into your gut health. If you're looking at a footy oval, you're not going to get as much effect as if you're looking at native bush. So even just at a psychological level, the more biodiverse space is probably better. And you would expect from a microbiological point of view that the biodiverse space would be better for exactly the same reason. There is a caveat to that, though, and we're talking about this from a very developed middle-class Western sort of perspective. If your environment is full of cholera and malaria, like we were discussing earlier as well, then green space exposure might actually be detrimental because it's going to kill your kids or whatever. In our environment, though, the environmental prevalence of pathogens, so the amount of cholera or malaria or any other horrible thing in the environment, is very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
So from a public health point of view, it's quite a safe thing, relatively speaking, to recommend that people spend more time in green space for that reason. But you have to be very careful about the environment you're in. We've just, for example, had an outbreak of Japanese encephalitis virus because of the flooding along the Murray River. And in that environment, you want to stay indoors until the outbreak is over and the mosquitoes go away because it's too cold in winter. So there are a few little caveats, but in general terms, green space that is biodiverse, on balance of probability, is better for you.
But, you know, we are facing increasing pandemics. We are facing increasing transfers of diseases from animals to humans as well. Maybe it just appears that way.
Absolutely.
So how do we get that balance? Don't go into deepest, darkest Peru without your immunizations, I guess might be a solid piece of advice for anybody. But being too exposed to areas that have a lot of detrimental disease is problematic. Being exposed to areas where there's no microbes has an autoimmune challenge to it. So it's a kind of Goldilocks zone in the middle.
Spot on.
How do we find that Goldilocks zone?
Yeah. So more research, can we have more money, please?
It's always the answer from researchers, right? So.
No, you're absolutely right. It's pretty clear from over-urbanized environments where kids are sitting on, you know, PlayStation in a concrete box and getting no microbiome exposure or even just the visual psychological benefits of green space is no good. And if you're in an environment, as we've said, where the water is going to kill you or the mosquitoes are going to kill you, that's no good either. So we've probably got a pretty good balance in our traditional Australian urban with a garden sort of situation. Unfortunately, due to financial pressures and changes in urban planning, a lot of those gardens are being filled in. And people like a bigger house rather than a garden, and that reduces the opportunities for diverse microbial exposure for, you know, kids growing their carrots in the backyard sort of thing. So the Goldilocks zone, as you astutely describe it, probably lies about 50 years ago when we had got rid of most of the killer infections that kids still unfortunately get in the third world. But before we moved to this concrete jungle with no backyard and few street trees, or at least not biodiverse street trees.
So we shouldn't be in any doubt that eradicating those killer diseases is a good thing. And moving away from that is a good thing for us to do. It's just we should probably take a step back from an over-urbanized society to a time and indeed to a place, hopefully a future place as well, where there is green and green infrastructure in and around our cities for us to be bathed in the wonders and benefits of a beneficial microbiome.
And exactly that is happening now, you know, like Green Adelaide, for example. We're Adelaide based and the organization and links around trying to green the city are growing, you know, really rapidly and really intelligently. And that's, you know, fantastic to see. But yeah, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. As you say, we don't want to be back in a time where we're at risk from environmental pathogens. Mm. But if we develop that green space in an intelligent way, we can get the best of both worlds.
So let's come back to schools, because I think that early exposure, as research is suggesting, is really important. Why can't we do more at schools? Why can't we make school environments much more biodiverse? Why can't departments for education invest in this? Why can't we have, you know, voluntary bees at the weekend to go and do some plantings? Why you persuaded me? Surely we should be doing this.
So there's some early evidence even that biodiversity exposure will improve cognitive outcomes. So learning in
school children. I'm even more persuaded now.
Yeah, exactly. But it's what I was saying before. You know, historically, the environment sector doesn't talk to the health sector, and the budget flow is completely different. If you want to add in an additional level of complexity, which is the education sector, and find, you know, a convergence.
Okay, that sounded all too difficult. But parents can also get involved as well. And this opportunity to have a new generation that grows up surrounded by green space, that's the norm, that's their expectation, that's the expectation then for their children that do this. This could quite easily, you know, the link could be broken here, could be reset for future, couldn't it?
Theoretically, yes, and, you know, certainly pushing for that. I think one of the big challenges with a lot of schools here is that they actually are over capacity. So a lot of schools have had green spaces available and then they put the transportable buildings on because they need another couple of classrooms. And so they're losing that kind of green space within their environment as well. So there is, you know, a shift towards new schools and things changing at the moment. And hopefully that will clear up some of that space that then can be brought back as green space and hopefully more diverse space. So I think it depends on the school and what opportunities they have available. And obviously funding, so it's not the cheapest thing to go and buy a whole bunch of shrubs and trees and things. But yeah, as you say, if we've got the evidence, then that should be able to overcome some of those funding challenges. But I think the space is a big part. And in Australia, we're obviously talking a lot about housing at the moment. And this is a similar issue in that we don't actually have the spaces to turn into green spaces. And we're losing a lot of our green spaces. So like the
we're
spaces,
turning green spaces into housing.
Exactly.
Right?
So, yeah. So in Adelaide, around Glenside, where the hospital was, a lot of that was green space around Hampstead, another rehabilitation hospital. They had a lot of green space and that's now been turned to housing because we need the housing. And so having that really clever town planning, both in terms of, you know, green space and housing, but also then having enough schools that those schools don't get over capacity where they're actually losing the open spaces to classrooms. So yeah, it's a really complex issue that extends beyond lots of the particular departments. It really needs that collaboration for things.
But
really
even some kind of guidelines of, you know, recommendations for green space, both in housing developments and in schools, could be then adhered to, you know, depending on budget and depending on support.
Yeah.
Yeah, Andy, the key point that has to be made in the context of urban planning, I think, is the, you know, we're all very aware of climate change now. And there's no question that green space in a city decreases the impact of climate change. So a city will cause a heat island effect, a few degrees hotter than ambient because of all the, you know, hot concrete and no green space to absorb the heat. So you can reduce that heat island effect that cities have by introducing green space into cities, and that'll have a huge health impact. There's now very significant evidence supporting that fewer people will die as a result of heat stroke and other ill effects of climate change if you green urban spaces to reduce that heat island effect.
And that's trees, it's mid-story, it's understory as well. And then you've got your diversity back into your city. So where on earth is doing it really well? Have you got any really good examples of places that have kind of understood this? It might have been a co-benefit that just came out from understanding that spending time in nature is a good thing, but which countries do this really well?
So I think from a research perspective, most of the research has happened in Finland. And as we indicated earlier, they have, you know, childcare centres and schools that are actually outdoors in the forest. So they've got a tradition of spending more time outdoors. Though it's very cold, they will still, you know, be able to spend that time outdoors. And so there's a bit more of a cultural factor, I guess, there that's then been embraced and allowed them then to look at it from a research perspective, including the microbiome. So the childcare study that I briefly mentioned before, one of them was looking at kids who were actually in one of the childcare centres that spent time in the forest and then a normal kind of urban childcare centre, and they compared their immune function and microbiome. By actually greening those spaces in the traditional or the urban centres, they were able to then have similar immune function and microbiome to the forest setting, which is really encouraging because it does mean that if people don't have ready access to biodiverse spaces, they can still be done on a smaller scale that can then allow those benefits to happen. So I think that's where, at least from that, as I say, research perspective, Finland is doing really nice work at starting to spread, which is great. And there are certainly a lot of examples of urban greening that have been done nicely throughout the world. It's just kind of where there's been an opportunity to do that in an intelligent way that we're just starting to see some of these really nice examples come through.
And working out where to plant what is key to that. And Andy, you mentioned just earlier whether, you know, all green space is equivalent, and we discussed that it's not. But, you know, the additional thing to consider there is if green space exposure is benefiting the health of the kids in Finland and it's benefiting our kids here, and the native vegetation is completely and totally different, like they've got, you know, Christmas trees growing there and we've got eucalyptus trees growing here.
Yeah.
The generalizability of the statement green space exposure is good for your health really needs to be explored in the context of completely different plant ecologies.
And the microbiomes that they support and the microbiomes people generations ago were exposed to, and whether they're the same.
Yep.
I mean, it's a complex set, isn't it?
And the fact that all populations all over, regardless of age, sex, religion, ethnicity, all seem to benefit from green space. You would think phylogenetically, in terms of, you know, where we originally came from, that evolutionary exposure that we're adapted to, there's something fundamental about that that we don't really understand yet.
So you've persuaded me, right? So I'm going to go with my placard to the premiere and say green space now. That there's a whole range of opportunities, I think. You know, mentioned schools. I mean, workplaces could have it.
Yeah.
Shopping centres could have it. Airports could have it. We could encourage more green space in everyday situations, you know, to encourage that exposure, and also for people that don't have it at home. I mean, there's a whole, you know, street trees, there's a whole range of kind of opportunities where this could be relatively easily implemented and would have additional benefits.
Yeah.
Surely there would be a cost benefit. We might be able to get some money from the health budget, wouldn't we, to proactively support these kind of initiatives.
Hopefully, it'd be lovely. Yeah, as you say, there are lots of theoretical easy wins in terms of that. So what we can actually try and integrate into places people are already at, I think, is really key.
Mm.
But it's making sure there's actually the space available. So we've recently done a survey with allied health professionals asking about what they would like in green spaces, what they've done in terms of advocacy and provision, and the challenges they've faced. And for a lot of them, it was reporting that in the spaces they were trying to green, there wasn't actually a space they were able to. So in a hospital setting or a clinic setting, there wasn't actually the room to do it. So there might be some opportunities in terms of, say, having indoor plants where you're still not going to get huge biodiversity, but it might be enough for some improvement. The other big thing is having windows that open and actually opening them. So a lot of modern buildings don't permit the windows to be open for climate control, which then means we're not actually getting those potentially beneficial microbes into our environment, even if we're not in that green space.
Mm.
I think the big group that, or the groups that get missed, are actually the most vulnerable people in our community who can't actually go into green space. As much as we say, go and spend some time in green space, they're not able to. So this might be aged care residents, people in long stay hospital. So there's a whole range of people who really probably need it more than the rest of us who are missing out. So there needs to be very targeted approaches to help them in particular.
Mm.
And if we're able to reduce the disease burden, you know, the cost to the healthcare system, by allowing people to benefit from that green space exposure, there's a huge saving to be had there. And there's also, as you'll know better than we do, a big investment into biodiversity conservation. Biodiversity is being monetized, and all of that investment and all of the health investment, if they could be synergized so we can improve biodiversity conservation and decrease disease by planting the right things in the right place with biodiverse microbes, plants and animals, that could be a win-win for both sectors.
Mm.
And unfortunately, historically, environment doesn't tend to talk much to health and vice versa. So a few programs are trying to meet in the middle, and hopefully some of our research will contribute to the evidence base that supports the need for thinking about those two disciplinary areas in an integrated way.
And we're starting the conversation today, right? So yeah, that's a good opportunity. You talk about an important issue there, which is the recognition of the value of nature. Sure, that's been monetized in terms of carbon credits and opportunities for carbon sequestration, but a broader recognition of those values of nature in terms of benefits to people and the human health, the public health aspect,
yep,
is a really significant,
yep,
component that we've have taken for granted, taken for free. And if it disappears, it's going to have real health implications.
And people are very focused on their own benefit and their own health, obviously. And a lot of policy and, you know, the profits that people make from cutting down forests, for example, their enthusiasm for that profit-making enterprise might be reduced if they knew that it was bad for their health to do so. So conversely, if conservation could be seen as a health benefit, more individuals would probably engage in it rather than dismissing it in favor of short-term profits.
Mm. A complex area if we don't have time to get into today, but let me just take a slight tangent. What happens if I go on a mission to Mars? You know, will you be able to give me a kind of nasal spray or some kind of mist or a tablet to kind of supplement my microbiome? What are the opportunities for places where you can't get your microbes?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And there's some work happening. I'm certainly not an expert, so we're getting a little bit beyond my scope, but there's certainly some work happening in terms of paints that are available that are inoculated or being developed, sorry. Tiles are being talked about. So there are some things happening that could assist with that, and they certainly could help with those environments that I was talking about before in terms of people, say, in aged care and having an extra boost, I guess, of microbes if they're not able to go outside. So there could be some benefits in terms of what we're talking about because of the investment in things like space travel that will need to overcome some of these challenges.
Now, we know the Australian Research Council had just funded a large centre of excellence in space plants.
Plants for space.
Yeah. If you grow, watercress on your way to Mars, it gives you both a source of food and potentially some aerobiome that might be beneficial. But we know little enough about the benefits of the biodiversity that relates to animals and plants and soil microbes on Earth to take that extra step yet.
Let's complete the analysis on Earth first, and then we can take it global or interplanetary. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I want to just kind of bring us back towards the end of the interview, and I'd like to ask you a question. So you're obviously dealing with some very interesting areas. What do you think is one of the more important things to consider? Would you consider hope or wonder as the most important component?
I think both. I don't think you can separate them. I think most of the science research, the fundamental science, is interest driven. And to build on those discoveries is hope for better future and better health and more green space and better conservation. So the two go hand in hand. You can't do one without the other. And I dare say, from a public health point of view, I always like to think about the precautionary principle, which is basically saying if something is probably good for you and unlikely to do you harm, you should probably do it. And that's a little bit different from the sort of laboratory science where you want, absolutely conclusive evidence with statistical significance that, this is so. But if you're talking about health and species extinctions, that intersection between biodiversity conservation and improving human health, if it seems good, the thing to do would be to start doing it now. And if you get it wrong, you can always adjust it later. But if you don't start doing it, people will die and species will go extinct.
That's a challenge. Just what about you?
I guess coming from a researcher's point of view, wonder is more where my mind's at. I guess the curiosity is where we get a lot of our new ideas and that novel approach. So, 30 years ago, we wouldn't have been talking about the things we're now talking about. And it's because people have been curious about things and built on what was already there. So I think that's absolutely required, but it does then give us hope, I guess, in terms of improving outcomes for the future. Mm. And obviously a lot of what we talked about today has parallels with climate change and things. So a lot of the things that we're concerned about, this kind of adds into that, I guess, gives us hope in terms of tackling some of those big challenges. So I guess a bit like Phil, I'm kind of somewhere in between, but I think the wonder bit is probably where, that novel idea and those solutions can come from.
It's kind of a bit of a spectrum, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you're more towards the kind of wonder side, and I think Phil's a bit more towards the hope side. Great. Jess and Phil, thanks very much for a fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
After that conversation with Phil and Jess, I feel really inspired to go and do something positive for the environment and my health. Do a bit of gardening, going for a hike, planting trees at my children's school, or lobbying for more green spaces in our cities. Why not join me? This has been another episode of Ecofuturists. We love delving into the big ideas that tie into our environmental future. So if you want to get involved, you can join the conversation on Twitter, leave us a review, or send us an email at environment@adelaide.edu.au. And of course, this season we're supported by the Environment Institute, so you can find out more information there too. We'll pop all these details in the show notes. Otherwise, be sure to follow this podcast and turn your notifications on so you never miss an episode. If you know an ecofuturist who might enjoy this chat, send this episode to them. Until then, I'm Professor Andy Lowe, and I'll see you again next time. This has been Ecofuturists, supported by the Environment Institute at the University of Adelaide.